Intruder alert, intruder alert.
Welcome aboard, Captain. Fighter pilots needed in Sector Wars. Play Astro Blaster.
R2 trying to increase the power.
Yahoo!
You're all clear, kid!
Hey there, friends! Thanks for joining us once again for the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. I am your host, Vic Sage, and for this episode of the show, we are going to be talking about not one specific game, but rather discussing an iconic game designer. This is something I asked a couple of months back on the Diary of an Arcade Employee Facebook page, if you felt that now and again, we should break from the Game a Week format. So, on this episode, we are going to be discussing the career and legacy of Howard Scott Warshaw, the legendary designer of Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, as well as Yar's Revenge for the Atari 2600.
You're a fly named Yar on a quest in space. You attack the shield of the Kotile's base, but watch out, Yar.
He knows where you are, Yar. Have you played Atari today?
With ion zones and evil drones, there's nothing else like Yar's Revenge, the way out space game that's new from Atari. Who else?
Have you played Atari today?
Howard Scott Warshaw is probably best known for Yar's Revenge and E.T. the Extraterrestrial. The latter title is the often maligned Atari 2600 game that has over the years been blamed for helping to topple the Atari empire after its release, which is totally untrue to say the least. With Yar's Revenge being one of the best-selling original games for the Atari 2600, you have this kind of perceived high and low mark set by Warshaw. And while I'm only speaking for myself, from my experience as well as my family's experience with the games that Howard created, in my humble opinion, he delivered three solid titles. While many fans of the Atari 2600 feel that Yar's Revenge is one of the greatest original games, and rightfully so, the funny thing is, my first two Howard Scott Warshaw games were Raiders of the Lost Ark and E.T., which I received for Christmas of 1982. I wouldn't even get the chance to play Yar's Revenge until nearly a year later, when my grandmother picked it up at a garage sale for a couple of bucks. As this show is focusing on Howard Scott Warshaw, I will be delving into the three games he worked on, but perhaps not as deeply as I would in a standard episode. I'm not going to give you a score breakdown or anything like that. Howard was born in Colorado, and he said that he was raised in New Jersey but earned his higher education in Louisiana. The interesting thing to me is learning that Howard Scott Warshaw had not intended to go into game development or even held any interest in computers when he began attending Tulane University. He was aiming for a double major in economics as well as math at the New Orleans Research University. After 3 years attending the private university, he had obtained a double major bachelor's degree in those fields, in addition to being Phi Beta Kappa. Apparently, those around him at the time, I assume it was faculty, pointed out that if Warshaw truly wanted to get ahead, he needed to become familiar with computers. Howard had a scholarship awarded to him for a one-year master's program for his efforts in computer science, which he used to earn a degree in computer engineering. As I understand it, he had taken a half-credit course during his studies that focused on Fortran programming, and he became hooked on the possibilities of computers from that point out, which is how he landed a job at Hewlett-Packard after graduation. Howard Scott Warshaw was hired as a multi-terminal systems programmer, working on the ARPANET, which, thanks to the Wikipedia, explains, quote, "The Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, ARPANET, was the first wide area packet switching network with distributed control and the first network to implement the TCP/IP protocol suite. Both technologies became the technical foundation of the internet," end quote. Which, I think you agree, is pretty cool. That Howard had, through his work, a hand in the foundation of the internet. In some interviews, Warshaw mentioned that his personality might not have been the right fit for Hewlett-Packard, considering he was a young man. And when I think back to how I behaved working at a high-end restaurant in my own youth, that should probably be its own podcast. Anyway, it's easy to see why when a friend of his at Hewlett-Packard mentioned he might be happier at the place his wife was employed, which was, of course, none other than Atari. Howard applied at Atari and has said that he wasn't exactly offered a position right away. In fact, in an interview with Matt Barton back in 2010, he remarked that the reason he wasn't initially offered a job was because they feared he might be too straight for the company. If you have seen the excellent Atari Game Over documentary, or watched videos of some of the members of the Atari staff from back in the day, you know that it had a pretty laid-back attitude in the beginning. Recreational drinking, hot tubs, and more were common. I guess it's safe to say that Nolan Bushnell, who had been forced out by 1978, had fostered something of a party environment. The payoff was it made Atari a place that programmers and its employees wanted to hang out at. It's not really a job if you're having fun doing it, as they say. Warshaw kept at it, asking just for a chance to show that one, he wasn't a stiff shirt, and two, he could create games that would wow both Atari and players. This was in 1981, and at the age of 24, he joined the Atari staff with absolutely no game programming experience. But he did possess the overwhelming desire and confidence to succeed. By the time that Howard Scott Warshaw was brought on board, the Atari VCS, which, as I believe, wasn't rebranded as the Atari 2600 until 1982, had finally become a hit home console for the company, thanks in no small part to Atari licensing Space Invaders for a home port, which I discussed on a previous episode. A few of the other popular titles that had been released by the time Warshaw joined Atari include Breakout, Missile Command, Asteroids, and Warlords. Howard's first task was to figure out how to produce a port of Cinematronics' 1980 arcade classic, Star Castle, which, when I tackled it for an earlier show, I made sure to share that it managed to be a game that upset my father a little when he was playing it. While Warshaw felt that the limitations of the Atari 2600 at that time would hinder a successful port of Star Castle, it did lead to the genesis of the idea for Yar's Revenge. In an interview with Digital Press by Scott Stilfen, when asked about the equipment he was using at Atari, Howard stated, quote, "We used a VAX system to compile a symbol and then downloaded the code to an emulator box for execution, patching, and debugging. I was given the system's manual and, after learning it, was assigned to do my first game, a version of Cinematronics' Star Castle. I soon realized that a decent version couldn't be done, so I took what I thought were the top logical and geometric components of Star Castle and reorganized them in a way that would better suit the machine. This eventually became Yar's Revenge." End quote. I'll be sure to include a link to that Digital Press interview on the podcast post for this episode on the Pop Culture Retrorama site. From that interview, I learned that Yar's Revenge was not the original title for the soon-to-be very successful game. The original title was Time Freeze, as Warshaw wanted to develop a title that would result in the first full-screen explosion in an Atari 2600 game. The Time Freeze title related to a moment in the game where time would come to a standstill or freeze, and then an explosion countdown would begin. You can see how Howard was able to take elements of Star Castle and use them in what would eventually be called Yar's Revenge, which is a title for the game, by the way, that Warshaw came up with. And while I realize that it is well known, Yar's Revenge might have been chosen as the title by marketing thanks to Howard letting slip it was named after then Atari CEO Ray Kassar. Yar being Ray spelled backwards, with Howard mentioning in the backstory he created for the game that it takes place in the Razak solar system, which, when spelled backwards, is Kassar. Close enough to Kassar, right? It took 7 months for Howard Scott Warshaw to get the game designed, and I've read online that it underwent an additional 5 months of testing and reworking the game off and on until it was ready to be released in May of 1982. Actually, Thanks again to that digital press interview, it sounds like the head of the home video games division, which, as the digital press interview points out, was Steve Wright, apparently couldn't be counted among the fans of the game. In fact, Warshaw states, quote, he hated the game and kept insisting there was something wrong with it. He eventually sent it to be playtested, end quote. What title was Yar's Revenge tested against, though? That was Rob Phillips' fantastic port of Missile Command. And even though Howard was worried, it turned out that the game earned itself an average rating of 4.5 out of 5, which was apparently the highest rank an original Atari game had earned at that time. When Yar's Revenge was originally released, it contained a 9-page comic book that explained the science fiction backstory of how common house flies, hitching a ride on an advanced rocket ship from Earth, mutated into the Yars after the ship crashed. Taking over multiple planets in the Razak solar system, designing the Zorlon cannon in an effort to protect themselves and their society. Thanks to that comic book, we find out that Planet 4 is destroyed by the Kotile race, an enemy of the Yars. The remains of the planet is now known as the Neutral Zone, and the dreaded Kotile have set up a base on the moon past the debris of Planet 4, ready to launch what is known as a swirl at the Yar's scouts brave enough to feast on the energy shields protecting the Kotile base, in an attempt to create an opening so the Zorlon cannon can be fired, taking out the villainous Kotiles in their enemy base.
Fly. I'll have a mutant fly. Hello, Yar. You'll need some protection. Ion zone. Shift chroma. Intensify. Okay. Now you need some weapons. You have a formidable enemy, the Kotile. Watch it, Yar. He has a lethal drone and some other tricks up his sleeve. Spiral. Go. Oh, good move, Yar. Now, I have a surprise for you. A Zorlon cannon. Use it, Yar. Fire again. Time. That's revenge. Yar's revenge. This could be fun. This could be a lot of fun, like asteroids. Yes, that's it. Get him. Get him. Beautiful. Watch it. Disintegrate. Now, let's go into deeper space. Galactic map, okay? Sector 11. Hyperspace. Sights in. Cylon warships. Attack. Photons. Star Raiders. That's it. Star Raiders. That'll keep them on their toes. Let's see what we can come up with next.
We're Atari. We have the vision, and we invented the technology to bring it home to you.
Howard Scott Warshaw received credit for programming Yar's Revenge, at least he did in the comic book as the cartridge programmer, with Hope Schaefer being given credit for writing the story, although Warshaw has said he was the one who actually wrote the comic book. I know that Hope Schaefer shows up on the Atari Sword Quest series of comic books that Atari and DC published for the Sword Quest games. I'm afraid I'm not sure if that was a real person or not. I can't find any other writing credits beyond those two. Although, I know that the artwork for the comic was courtesy of Frank Sirocco, Ray Garst, and Hiro Kimura. The latter is responsible for the amazing artwork used on the box art for Yar's Revenge. You know, the one that looks like it should be on the side of a van. Sadly, when my grandmother picked up Yar's Revenge at that garage sale, the comic book wasn't included. Yar's Revenge was a hit upon release, going on to sell over 1 million copies, which, I recall, new Atari games costing around $39.99. So theoretically, Atari pocketed nearly $39 million on Howard's game. Did you know, though, not only was Warshaw working on a tie-in game, a sequel of sorts to Yar's Revenge called the Yarian Olympics, in addition, he was approached about having the game turned into an arcade title by none other than Missile Command and Tempest's David Thurer. Obviously, that never went anywhere, but how awesome would it have been if it had made it into production as an arcade title? It was the design for the Yarian Olympics that Howard Scott Warshaw was working on when Atari asked him to devote his efforts to another game, a title based off a little film that came out in 1981, and I guess did okay for itself. I'm talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Can Indiana Jones escape from the forces of evil? Can he survive 13 fiendish situations? Will Indy make it all the way? Find out in Atari's Raiders of the Lost Ark adventure game. It's diabolically difficult. It's mysterious. It's never the same twice. And it's only from Atari.
Howard Scott Warshaw found himself being flown out to meet with Steven Spielberg, who agreed that the young man was the right person to tackle the Raiders of the Lost Ark game. And, once again, thanks to that digital press interview, it sounds like what really impressed Spielberg is that Warshaw saw it as a chance to make the next adventure game, building upon that classic Atari 2600 title. I also believe that Raiders of the Lost Ark was the very first cartridge to have been based on a movie. Considering all of the elements of the Raiders of the Lost Ark film, it made perfect sense. I've read on multiple spots on the internet that it took anywhere from 6 to 10 months to get the game ready to be shipped out to the stores in 1982. November, actually, with his next game, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, shipping the following month. Apparently, Spielberg would check in on the development of the game, with Warshaw and the director having lunch now and again. But it sounds like Howard was totally left to himself and had no interference. I've also read that he really threw himself into the game, with an interview from Now Gamer where the programmer stated, quote, "When I was coding Raiders of the Lost Ark," says Warshaw, "I really tried to get into character. I wore the hat and had a real 10-foot-long leather bullwhip. Man, it was loud. Like a gunshot. I said it was for R&D, research and discipline. If people were snooping around the building, I'd sneak up behind them and crack the whip. They'd jump out of their suits and I'd be like, hey, how you doing?" End quote. One of the things that Howard did with the design of the game is to sacrifice some graphics to make the game larger, which also resulted in needing the use of two joysticks to play the game properly. This is something that Bob Smith's Riddle of the Sphinx game by Imagic would also do. I want to say that Riddle of the Sphinx came out first in 1982, but don't quote me on that. Just going off the memories of my youth, you used the right joystick controller to move Indiana Jones around the multiple rooms, as well as using the item that is highlighted in your inventory. You can select from said inventory with the left joystick controller. Over the years that I was lucky enough to write for The Retroist, and even on various diary podcasts, I have talked quite a bit about my grandmother. For good reason. She totally was a kid at heart. And, of my family, she possibly played more home console games than even I did. Thanks to games like Riddle of the Sphinx, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Sword Quest, and up to some of the Super Nintendo titles, she kept a notebook that was filled with hints, puzzle solutions, and thoughts on various games. I am in possession of that notebook now that she has sadly passed away, and a couple of pages are devoted to Raiders. If you played the game, you know that the instruction manual is less than forthcoming with how to overcome some of the puzzles, which is how Warshaw intended it, I believe. Because for weeks and weeks, my grandmother and I would just sit down in front of the television console and just try over and over and over again to beat the game. Even to the point where I would be dropped off by my father before school just so my grandmother and I could try to get just a bit further than the previous day. Was it hard? Yeah, a little, but it gave me the feeling of being Indiana Jones. I can particularly recall how awesome I felt when I used the medallion in the map room for the first time, or put two and two together to get past the raving lunatic in the black market. Just like with Yar's Revenge, Raiders of the Lost Ark ended up selling over a million copies of the game, so we can assume it at least made $30 million in sales. And it sounds like Steven Spielberg was rather impressed by the finished product. Watching a playthrough of Warshaw that was taped for the Consumer Electronics Show, Spielberg reportedly commented that he felt as if he had just watched a movie instead of just a video game. Pretty high praise indeed. Which is why Warshaw was asked for by Spielberg when the deal for Atari to produce a game based on E.T. the Extraterrestrial was finalized. Howard Scott Warshaw still had to make a pitch to Spielberg, coming up with the idea for the gameplay in 36 hours. There was another hitch to Warshaw accepting the assignment. The game had to be done in 5 weeks.
Hello? Somebody out there?
Cartridge you have to buy separately to play on the Atari video computer system. Your parents hook it up to the TV. It's the video game that lets you help E.T. get home.
Bye,
E.T. This is the Atari video computer system. E.T. and other video game cartridges are each sold separately.
For the January 1983 issue of Electronic Fun with Computer and Games, in the news section, was a headline that read, Spielberg helps design new E.T. game. With a short piece stating, quote, rather than simply giving Atari permission to turn E.T. into a game, Steven Spielberg was directly involved in all aspects of the design work, end quote. The article, besides providing a photograph of both Spielberg and Howard Scott Warshaw, also mentions that the Raiders of the Lost Ark TV commercial for the Atari 2600 game had been storyboarded by Spielberg, and he had chosen the director, cinematographer, and camera operator. Not sure how true those statements were. So, 5 weeks was all that Howard Scott Warshaw had to produce the E.T. the Extraterrestrial game. Granted, he was a young man, but this is something that had never been accomplished before. 35 days to produce an original A-title game for Atari. So, Warshaw had a game design lab put into his home, working 14 hours a day, crafting a game that would allow E.T. to attempt to gather the pieces of a phone to build the communications equipment to call his people to come and rescue him. Traveling through 6 different areas, which wrapped around on themselves, the player needs to build the device before he runs out of energy, as well as avoid losing pieces of the phone he has collected to the FBI agent, or all of his Reese's Pieces if he isn't currently in possession of a piece of the communicator. There's also a scientist that will take E.T. back to Washington. E.T. can use his powers in different ways in various areas of the game, which are marked by certain icons at the top of the screen. This costs energy. Even moving E.T. costs energy. Making him run costs even more. Thankfully, E.T. can down some of those Reese's Pieces in a eat candy zone to replenish some of his energy. Or he can save them, not only for points at the end of the game, but to give them to Elliot to get a piece of the communicator. The E.T. character in the game will extend his neck upwards, much like in the film, when using his special abilities. The pieces of the phone are randomly hidden in every game, in the pits or wells that dot the maps. 3 pieces of the phone are needed before E.T. can phone home. The main problem with the E.T. the Extraterrestrial game is those pits. It is far too easy to fall into one of them. Or, having used your levitation ability to rise out of the pit, if you aren't careful, you will just fall right back in and have to do it again. In my opinion, it was something that back in the day, you just accepted. You learned to get better, so to speak. Off subject for a second, it's a bit like the port for Pac-Man to the Atari 2600. Everybody complains about how bad it is, but I cannot tell you how many hours my grandmother and myself played the game, because it was fun. We knew it was different, but it gave us enough of the experience of the arcade game to enjoy at home. I received Raiders of the Lost Ark and E.T. the Extraterrestrial on that Christmas of 1982, and I honestly played both of them. All the time. Now, I don't think E.T. is a perfect game by any means. Even Howard Scott Warshaw has gone on record saying that he wished he worked a little more on the collision detection for those pits. But it is in no way the worst game that was ever made for the Atari 2600. Now, E.T. was a game, though, to be fair, that I was the one always playing. My grandmother didn't care for it all that much. It also happens to be the game where I uncovered my first Easter egg. Howard Scott Warshaw programmed Easter eggs into all 3 of his games for Atari, with his initials in Yar's Revenge, the Yar's Housefly in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and with E.T., he put in his initials, as well as those of the graphic designer, who was Jerome Domara, in addition to an Indiana Jones icon, and of course, once again, the Yar's Housefly, which is the one I found. My father and grandmother were in the backyard talking, and I was just playing the game. I fell into a well and was using E.T.'s ability to resurrect the dead plant down at the bottom of the pit. Suddenly, it transformed into the Yar's Housefly and flew out of the well. Friends, I literally lost my mind. I ran screaming from the house for my grandmother and father, just babbling about what had taken place. It's not like there was a pause button. It wasn't until many years later when I was able to show my grandmother a video on YouTube that she finally believed me that it had happened. The development process for E.T. the Extraterrestrial was so fast, there wasn't even a group put together to playtest the game. Even as is, the game managed to sell over 1.5 million copies. Depending on the online sources I've read, it could have sold upwards of 2.5 million. Atari, though, had spent $21 million just to obtain the rights to license the game, and going on to produce 5 million cartridges. Okay, it has been said, depending on what source online you're reading, 3.5 million cartridges were returned to Atari. Yet again, I've seen multiple articles and videos calling E.T. the Extraterrestrial a flop, a failure. And I have to agree with Patrick Hickey Jr., who, in his fantastic book, The Minds Behind the Games, interviews with cult and classic video game developers, states, quote, "Only Pac-Man, Pitfall, Asteroids, Missile Command, Space Invaders, and Demon Attack have sold more copies on the Atari 2600 than E.T. the Extraterrestrial," end quote. I have to admit, I was a little surprised to learn that Demon Attack had done so well to be included in that short list. Off subject for just a second, seriously, The Minds Behind the Games is really, really good. You need to check it out. I have a copy of the book and purchased one for the arcade for its library. So, for the first couple of months, things were looking pretty good for Warshaw. For one thing, as per his agreement for accepting the job, he was given $200,000 and an all-expense-paid trip to Hawaii for actually doing what at that time was considered impossible. And that is the thing. Howard delivered a game that is good, although not great, but especially given the limited time he was afforded, Warshaw really did something amazing. Warshaw's E.T. game didn't kill Atari. A glut of horrid shovelware titles that you could pick up at the local gas station, along with mismanagement of finances at Atari, helped to trigger the video game crash of 1983. David Crane, who once worked at Atari and then left to co-found Activision, has made mention of how third-party developers began producing inferior products, and in an article published in the Milwaukee Journal, dated December 26 of 1982, it points to the fact that in the second half of that year, the amount of cartridges being produced for the Atari 2600 ballooned from 100 titles to 400. It was these glut of games, as well as a multitude of home consoles being offered, that also helped bring about the crash of 83. To say nothing of the fact that personal computers were beginning to really make the scene, taking away a portion of the customer base with them. Howard would work on one other title for the Atari 2600, a game called Saboteur, which wasn't finished by the time he left Atari. It apparently was then picked up and transformed as a tie-in to the popular A-Team TV series, although it too was never released, not officially. I know that Howard Scott Warshaw has never shied away from the legacy of E.T. In fact, he seems to be quite okay with folks in general labeling it as the worst Atari game ever made. He does so, I believe, because it allows him the opportunity to discuss the facts around its creation. There's quite a moving scene in that 2014 documentary, Atari Game Over, in regards to the Atari landfill and the emotional support that Warshaw receives from all of the fans that showed up at the dig site. I believe that documentary is on Netflix at the moment, and possibly even YouTube. Definitely worth your time to watch. Howard has been quoted many times about the 1982 E.T. the Extraterrestrial game. In fact, I found this quote on Wikipedia, which says, quote, "People worry I might be sensitive about the E.T. debacle, but the fact is, I'm always happy to discuss it. After all, it was the fastest game ever done. It was a million seller, and of the thousands of 2600 games, how many others are still a topic? Another thing I like to think about is having done E.T., consistently rated among the worst games of all time, and Yar's Revenge, consistently rated as one of the best. I figure I have the unique distinction of having the greatest range of any game designer in history." End quote. Howard would end up writing two books after he left Atari, Conquering College and The Complete Book of Pan. The latter is a guide to help players get better at the card game. Warshaw would go on to produce documentaries such as From There to Here, Scenes of Passage, which focused on two Russian women from the same family who were immigrants during different time periods. He also produced a documentary about the early days of Atari, entitled Once Upon Atari, which feature interviews and anecdotes from some of the folks who worked at Atari from the beginning to its end. Warshaw would become a psychotherapist, operating in the Silicon Valley and dubbing himself the Silicon Therapist. I know three games as your legacy may not seem like much, but the truth is, Howard Scott Warshaw, at the end of the day, produced three memorable Atari 2600 titles. And while some may not have cared for his last game, I want to thank him for giving a lonely 10-year-old boy something to play and enjoy trying to get E.T. home. Friends, here to speak a little more about Howard Scott Warshaw is Earl Green, who had the pleasure of meeting the former game designer.
We have transport.
I met Howard Scott Warshaw at the 2003 Classic Gaming Expo, where he was running a vendor booth hawking his homemade Atari documentary, Once Upon Atari, which I always found intensely entertaining, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. It was very much a homemade documentary, and that part of it kind of showed, but because the man behind it was one of their own, you got insights from people like Todd Fry, who programmed the Atari 2600 version of Pac-Man, things that they might not have told any other interviewer they felt comfortable telling to Howard, even though Howard was going to turn around and burn this on DVDs and sell it to the world at large. I always find it kind of interesting that Howard went into psychotherapy as a line of work after he was done with game development as his day-to-day source of income. And I also find it very interesting that some of his clientele apparently were younger game developers who Howard was having to help navigate the cutthroat world of 100-hour work weeks and other things that would break the back of just about anybody. I find this very interesting because think about this from Howard's perspective. You've done your best to program games that were assigned to you, software that was assigned to you, on budget, on time, within the restrictions applied by the hardware platform that you were using, and you do your best, you do your level best, and yet one of these, despite the fact that the other two, Raiders and Yars Revenge, are these barn burner best of things that all sorts of people say for years and years are brilliant, these same people are blaming you for what is supposedly the worst game of all time. Which, by the way, E.T. was not the worst game of all time because Mythicon, as a company, existed. Enough said. Being blamed for that for many years, alongside being, you know, marched through the parade grounds as, oh, he did these great games and this one that sucked worse than anything else in history ever has, that would be enough to send anybody to therapy. So my theory is that Howard himself may have wound up in therapy at some point because, bless him, you know, I can't imagine being on the receiving end of that much criticism from so many total strangers who were not in the room where it happened, to coin a phrase. So I think it's very admirable, not only that Howard has continued to associate with Atari fans the world over, I think it's admirable that he dedicated at least a small slice of his life to telling the story from the perspective that he and the other programmers were seeing at Atari. And I also think it's very admirable that, despite it all, he has chosen to go into a field where he was able to help others who were perhaps going through similar experiences to the ones that had rocked his world so many times and probably sent him to the therapist's couch on more than one occasion. In that respect, I think Howard Scott Warshaw is a treasure to the classic gaming community. After all of the abuse and criticism that he has put up with, he would have every right. I would not be the least bit surprised if he were to say, you know what, that's enough out of you, I'm done interacting with this community. But he hasn't done that. He hasn't done that. And E.T. was still better than anything Mythicon put out, so just saying.
It will probably not shock you to know that Shay Mathis, the manager and owner of the Arcadia Retrocade, made sure that we had all three games that Warshaw worked on for the Atari Couch area of the arcade. What might shock you to hear is how much E.T. the Extraterrestrial is played at the arcade. Well, before COVID-19 temporarily forced Shay to close the arcade down. Some of that is what you think. Kids hearing it was the worst video game of all time, which is why it's great to see them keep playing the game because they are enjoying it. Maybe not falling into the well so much, but they are enjoying the game overall nonetheless. Now, speaking of the Atari 2600 couch, I can tell you we were lucky enough to have the 2600 we opened the arcade with for nearly 7 years. We are rounding the corner on the 8th year of the arcade having been opened, by the way. The 2600 is a workhorse, stays on for 6 days a week for up to 12 plus hours a day. But, like I mentioned in the Empire Strikes Back episode, the foot traffic in front of the couch and TV set is never-ending. And the 2600 gets kicked. And sometimes, sadly, the cartridges are trampled by kids, teenagers, and even adults. Finally, after nearly 7 years, the 2600 just gave up the ghost. Which is, of course, when Shay turned to the chief tech at the arcade, Gary Burton, who has a little something to share about what it took to bring it back to life. Take it away, Gary!
Hello everyone, Gary here, the head game tech at Arcadia Retrocade, filling you in again on some recent work that's been going on behind the scenes. Anyone who claims to be a card-carrying fan of everything retro would instantly recognize the Atari 2600 home video game console that hit store shelves in 1977. Before its 15-year run came to an end in 1992, more than 470 titles were created for the console. While we don't have anywhere near every cartridge made for the system at the arcade, we have many of the most popular titles available for guests to enjoy. Keeping a console working that's more than 40 years old has been an ongoing battle, especially when you consider one has always been powered up 6 days a week and up to 10 to 12 hours each day. In the last year, at least three consoles have succumbed to heat, falling from the top of the television, and just being old. While we could go and buy another console locally at a retro store, the result would still be the same, a system more than 40 years old. A side effect of having several dead consoles laying around the tech bay is that we have plenty of spare parts available. Thankfully, none of the same parts have been the point of failure yet. I've been fortunate enough to breathe life back into the system at least three times in the last year by cannibalizing parts from its dearly departed brothers. A cracked cartridge slot, broken video cord, and main power switch have all been repaired with salvaged parts. No, we can't go on forever by using the spares, but at the cost of about $100 for each replacement system, we've managed to save about $300 this way and keep retired consoles out of the landfill. Have you played Atari today? Thanks for listening. Hope y'all have a great week. Bye-bye.
And friends, I think that about wraps up our episode. As always, I want to thank you again for taking the time to listen to the show. I really do appreciate your support and hope that you are enjoying this second season of the podcast. I know I'm no expert, just a fan of classic arcade and home console games and enjoy talking about them. The Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast is currently available on iTunes. I'm working on rebuilding the podcast library very, very slowly, I know. This is a result of switching from the Retroist site to the Pop Culture Retrorama one. You can check out daily posts there by visiting www.popculturetrorama.com. The Diary of an Arcade Employee is now available on Google Podcasts, Spotify, as well as Stitcher. No matter how you listen to the show, if you have a moment and enjoy the podcast, why not give us a rating and a review to help us find new listeners? You can find out more about the Arcadia Retrocade by visiting Facebook. Or if you want daily posts, you can check out the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast Facebook page. I share all manner of vintage arcade and home console fun multiple times a day. In addition, now on Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time, we host a watch party, showing old episodes of Starcade, Saturday Supercade, and just last week we showed the documentary about the Rock-a-Fire explosion from Showbiz Pizza. So I hope you can join us. Earl Green is a frequent contributor to the Pop Culture Retrorama site, as well as being a very good friend of the arcade, having donated most of his collection of home console games and more. Earl also happens to head up thelogbook.com, one of the longest-running websites for literally all things pop culture-related. Gary Burton frequently shares photographs from the work he's doing at the arcade. Just because it's temporarily closed doesn't mean he's not busy every day trying to bring an arcade machine back to life. He shares those on the Diary of an Arcade Employee Facebook page. In addition, from time to time, he contributes articles to the Pop Culture Retrorama site, too. If you have any feedback or comments about the podcast, I'd love to hear them. You can always reach me on Facebook or throw me an email at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. You also can often find me posting videos of the arcade on my Instagram account, which is simply vicsage_. I, of course, want to thank the Retroist. For over a decade, the Retroist provided a spot on the internet where fans of all things retro could visit and allow people to enjoy the best retro-related articles and podcasts. I certainly wouldn't have my own site or multiple podcasts without the Retroist support. Now, have a token on me as you listen to a clip of the subject for next week's show. This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by Atari, Nintendo, or any of the individuals and businesses that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips from the mentioned video games and commercials are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.
Fly, young warriors, fly. Spread your wings and take off into the morning sky. Fly, young warriors, fly. Attack, young warriors, attack.
End of line.